Good morning. Do we have everybody in line? Should we wait another minute?
Is anybody else there? Hello, hello. No,
that's
not.
Yeah, so let's wait. Wait a minute.
Okay. How is the weather in your area?
Nice.
What is?
Nice day today. All right, Les, thanks a lot for the confirmation online.
Morning, it's Stephen Count.
Hi, guys, good morning. Okay, no, Jim is not going to be with us today. I think he went on vacation for the next couple of weeks, so he'll be away till the 18th, he said. So why don't we start? And so we're up to here. We did 10, 11 is what we did last. And we were coming off a series of verses. We were showing how that although that there is a system that a person should follow in terms of intelligence and planning and how he should act and make his decisions, there will be certain questions that he has when he sees that people that are very foolish people sometimes end up in very influential positions. And that can throw a question into a person's plan. Well, if you could follow an intelligent plan and yet this is what can happen in the world, so what's the use? Well, we stressed that, according to verse 5, is only a minority of times. Sometimes, since there are so many variables, so there will be certain instances where the plan can't really pan out properly, or there might be certain things that are perceived as as injustice, but that shouldn't reflect poorly on the person's decisions, because the person still has to think rationally. He can't just abandon rationality. Because in certain cases, there's questions as to how this result happened. Because the bottom line is that in the vast majority of cases, intelligence is going to, intelligent plan is going to breed better results, better outcome. And that's why he concluded that he said that despite the fact that sometimes people of low status are in high positions and vice versa, nonetheless, If you dig a pit, you're going to fall into it. You break a fence, the snake is going to bite you. Meaning there is a system. There are results that happen. Even in those cases too, you could dig a pit and not fall into it, but it's definitely safer not to have dug a pit and not to have created danger. And that's where he ends off verse 10 by saying that a better tool, better preparedness is wisdom. Wisdom is definitely better. Despite the fact that if the axe head has not been sharpened, even though it can strengthen the warriors, nonetheless, intelligence is a better tool. Okay, that's where we ended up. That's where we ended off, I should say. And then he gave an example in 11 that if the snake bites because there was no charmer to charm the snake, so then there's no benefit to the speaker. If the intelligence wasn't used to avert a certain negative, so then what benefit was that intelligence? It wasn't applied. So although intelligence is good, he shows you another aspect to it, and that is that the intelligence has to be applied in order that it benefits a person. Other commentaries on this, I believe it was Sforno, says that this is a metaphor for speaking to a person who's a fool. That if the person is going to bite, that means the person is going to be a fool and keep on revisiting his sin, so then there's no benefit to a wise person to try to advise them otherwise. And that's what Sforno says. It's not going to help at all. So although wisdom, that's what he's doing, is showing you that although we've concluded that wisdom is the right path, despite the fact that some minor cases or exceptional cases, you won't understand why things are taking place, it didn't seem to follow the path, but for the most part, wisdom will produce better results than if you don't use wisdom. However, there's going to be instances where, even though how great wisdom is only good if you have a recipient that is going to grasp it. And a person that talks to a fool, it's falling on deaf ears. Okay, so now let's move further. So now we're doing a new verse. Okay. Yes, somebody had a question?
Yeah. On 11 here, if you just look at it kind of literally about charming and the snake and things.
Yes.
This verse to me seems to give credence to the practice of charming, and yet I've seen in other areas of the Torah that we're not supposed to really give any credence to those types of things.
Well, I think here he's talking about a real, something real, which means that snakes do get mesmerized by music. That's what we mean by charming here. Not that there's any other mystical force. So the literal read is taking something from nature which is true. I think you're referring to something more mystical, right? Something where the Torah violates any type of lucky charms or things like that. Is that what you're referring to?
Right.
Right, okay. Yeah, that was, we actually read that in yesterday's portion. But not to follow the ways of the heathens and their idolatrous, superstitious ways. Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting that yesterday's parsha also includes a word that's used, I've only seen twice in the Torah, and the Hebrew word is tamim, which means to be perfect or complete. So after the prohibitions of not following these idolatrous ways, these superstitious beliefs, God says you should be, well, Moshe, speaking, he says perfect should you be with God. Tamim, perfect, complete, you should be with God. I wonder why, after this series of last week's parsha, we talked about all the animal species that you are not kosher. Why doesn't it say at the conclusion there, perfect, you should be with God? Or when it talks about all the laws of stealing or rape or sexual matters, it doesn't say at the end of those, perfect, you should be with God, or complete, you should be with God. So what is it specifically about these superstitious beliefs. That here, Moshe gives a conclusion. Perfect, you should be with God. And the only other time I remember the Torah talking about this word perfect is when God was about to command Abraham in circumcision. And he says, go before me and be perfect. And what's interesting is in that verse, Ibn Ezra says four words. He gives a four-word commentary. And he says, you shouldn't ask why circumcision. Meaning to say, if you just elaborate what he means, he's saying you shouldn't ask why I should do circumcision. When God is telling Abraham that you should be perfect before me, Ibn Ezra is saying that God is telling Abraham, don't ask why you must do this command of circumcision. But that's the furthest thing from what Judaism is about. We're supposed to ask. It's all about intelligence. Everything has a reason. I mean, Maimonides even explains why you do it. To minimize the satisfaction that's derived sexually, in order that the person's energies can be more channeled to intelligence and perfection of a soul. The person was too immersed in the satisfaction of the sexual, so then, which would happen if he didn't have the circumcision, if the organ wasn't weakened, so then the person would be hard to escape from that desire. He'd be returning to that desire all his days. So, there, you know, Maimonides gives a great answer for that. So what is the statement of Ibn Ezra that when God says to Abraham that you walk before me and be perfect and do the circumcision? So what does it mean perfect over there? Ibn Ezra says that you shouldn't ask why do milah. I mean, of course you should ask. I mean, Ibn Ezra was one of the greatest commentators, and he explains reasons for everything in the Torah. So how could he of all people say this? A powerful question, right?
Right.
Yeah, so he's not saying that you shouldn't investigate the commands. Like Rabbi Chait once said, there's a Rashi in Deuteronomy that states that if a person doesn't understand the reason for the command, so then it's useless. And then he's just doing an action. That and the action per se doesn't do anything for a person if he doesn't understand why he's doing it. Just waving around a palm branch on a Sukkot holiday, or we're doing circumcision, the person has no idea why he's doing it. So wherein lies any benefit to the person? He's just physically doing an action like any other action. It's like eating an apple. What's the difference if there's no understanding? So Ibn Ezra can't mean that you shouldn't investigate what this idea is. But what he's saying is that you shouldn't make your understanding the criteria that determines whether you'll act. You shouldn't make your understanding, meaning Abraham, you know, Abraham shouldn't say to God, well, let me understand circumcision first, then I'll do it. That's what God was saying. And that's what Ibn Ezra was saying. He says that you shouldn't ask first what's the reasoning. I mean, don't let your intelligence be the determinant whether you're going to do it or not. This was a new lesson that God was giving to Abraham. Abraham, of course, engaged in the debate regarding Sodom and whether or not he would kill the people or not and how many people should be there. He was investigating. And God even said, well, I keep hidden from Abraham what I'm going to do, and he's going to be a great, mighty nation, and all the nations will bless him, and he'll teach his household after him the ways of God and to do charity and justice and kindness. So God did not want to hide the considerations of justice that he was administering. He didn't want to hide this from Abraham because he wants the world to know justice. So he engaged Abraham in a conversation. So Abraham, you know, just the opposite. He should understand the concepts of how God operates in the world. And that includes the commands. But there's an important thing that a person should not make his own intelligence a determinant of whether he acts or not. Because if it's coming from God, we're talking, so then it has to be a good. And that's why Abraham didn't ask God anything. As Rabbi Chait said, why Abraham didn't ask when God said to slaughter his son, he didn't debate him like he did by Sodom and Amorah when God was going to wipe out those cities, those five cities. Abishai explained, because in terms of understanding justice, that's something which Abraham understood he has to inquire about. But that a certain command should perfect him, meaning killing a son, so that this should be a perfection either for him or for a son or for both, Abraham recognized that I may not be able to grasp how it perfects me. So therefore there wasn't a question asked. Because there he understands that the perfection can take place. And it could be the same thing over here when Ibn Ezra is saying that he shouldn't ask why to do the circumcision. That shouldn't be determined. He should still do it. It still has a perfecting quality. And it's something which he eventually can ask. He should definitely ask about. But he has a command right now to do something, he should do it. But let's get back to the point regarding why in that case it says, go, you know, walk before me and be perfect. It says it by that case, and then it says it also by our case in the parsha yesterday about the idolatrous or superstitious actions. But it doesn't say be perfect when it concludes a series of other laws like that, the laws of kosher, or the laws of the sexual, or the laws of monetary. So why would it say it in connection with the prohibitions on superstition, but nowhere else? Why is it that the person is only complete there? What does it mean by complete or perfect, following God perfectly? So I believe what the unique quality is in these two cases is that when is a person following God perfectly or completely? When he doesn't assume some other power. So that's not going to apply to laws of kosher or stealing. A person steals or he doesn't keep kosher, he's not admitting of another deity. But if he follows superstitious ideas and he thinks that he does a certain thing, it's going to affect his reality. That's following another deity or a belief in some sort of power in addition to God. So then you will not be considered as following God solely or completely. You can't be completely following God if you're following other beliefs too, in terms of there being forces in the world. If you follow God, you don't need something kosher, that's not following another deity. So that's not called a deviation in terms of being perfect with God. So that makes sense, right? Do you see that a point? Okay. Okay. Then the only question will be then, so why does God say to Abraham, walk before me and be perfect? What is the use of that word in that case too? Why is that the only other case where you have where God says perfect?
Rabbi, can you repeat that question again?
Yes, the use of the word to perfect or holy, meaning complete, not holy like sanctified.
Right.
So why is that term only applied to idolatrous areas and when God said to Abraham, you should walk before me and be perfect? What's the common denominator between the two cases that the word can be equally applied there too?
Well, it means holy to some extent, but it means perfect is to emulate God, to do what he does.
Well, that wouldn't make sense, emulate God by
no.
By the case of circumcision.
Well,
I mean, any more than keeping kosher. I mean, both are restricting the instinctual.
I think being complete and being holy to God is doing the things that were outlined already that we know we have to follow, that we as mankind can follow.
But that was the very question. I mean, then you should use that word everywhere. Anywhere that God commands something, you should use it, but that's not the case.
Let
me see what Les is saying on screen. Les is saying that a lesson perhaps to show that man may not always understand God's ways, which are perfect, and that man may eventually come to the wisdom behind these things. True. That's true, Les. But it doesn't seem you're answering the question. You're making a point, which is true. That's what God was, according to Ebenezer, saying to Abraham in connection with the circumcision. But I believe the reason why this word is only used there and by idolaters is because there's only two areas in which a person can deviate from following God solely. So one way that that man can deviate from following God alone is when he follows belief in other deities, right? Mm-hmm. Where else? There's one other area a person can deviate and not follow God alone. It's not when he's following other deities, but he's following, there's one other thing he can follow that would also be a deviation from God. You mean himself? I would just broaden what you're saying. Meaning when he follows himself. Because following the instincts of the... You hear what I'm saying? It's meaning that... Go ahead.
Yeah, in a sense, when Hashem says be complete, complete with me means to be... doing the things that I've outlined to you, not to water it down.
No.
Then you're following it. No.
No, it's saying that, again, because it's only used in two cases, the word complete, or meaning it's only used in connection with idolatrous, and because according to what you're saying, so then after the laws of kosher, God should have said be complete there too. Those are also the things that he outlined. I'm saying that let me clarify it. To reserve the use of the term tumim, meaning be complete with God, that the question we have is why that's only applied to idolatrous areas. And when God said to Abraham, walk before me and be complete. It's not used in other cases, according to what you're saying, Rivka, that if it's just a matter of following God, his outlines, so that anywhere God says something in the Torah, it should use the word at the end, be complete. Keep all the kosher laws and be complete. Don't steal and be complete. Keep the sexual laws and be complete. But it doesn't do that. It only says don't follow superstitious notions. And then it says be complete.
Because that can cause death.
No. that can cause theft. I don't see what you're saying. How could that cause theft?
Well, it's because if he defies Hashem and he's an idolater, he could die.
So?
But that was the rules. Well, that then if a person doesn't want to die, they should be complete with Hashem in the way that they should be following Hashem, what Hashem outlined. Not be an idolater.
But what does death have to do with it? We're trying to understand the concept of being complete. Why complete is only termed. So we're saying like this, we're saying that when God says be complete, and it's only talking about the word complete when you deviate in terms of idolatry, it's because then you're assuming something else besides God to exist. If I don't keep kosher, or if I steal, or if I complete, you know, sexual improprieties, I'm not admitting of another deity. I'm just giving it to my instincts. But I'm not saying, when I eat something not kosher, I'm not saying there's another God. But if I assume that a statue has a certain power, if I wear a red string on my wrist and I assume that's going to protect me, if I do any of these type of, but have a trinket in my pocket, if I look at the stars and I say, oh, this is a sign that tomorrow is not going to be a good day, that means I'm now admitting of there being other powers in the world besides God. Then you're deviating from being completely following God because you're following other beliefs of powers. But you're not following other beliefs of powers when you eat something non-kosher.
Right.
Okay? So that's why it only says be complete in connection with idolatrous notions. Because that's when you're not completely following God. But there's one other area that you could also not be following God. It's not that you're following other powers, but that if you follow yourself. Because there's only two things that a person will admit have intelligence. There's God and there's man. But in the category of God, a person will think, well, maybe there's more than one God. And that's what all these idolatrous things are. There's these powers. There's these signs in the heavens and so on and so forth. So that's why there's only two areas that the Torah says don't make the mistake. Don't make the mistake and assume there's more than one God, meaning powers. And don't make the mistake that your intelligence is something which is worthy of being followed in place of God. So Abraham, do the circumcision, study it, but don't suspend the act of circumcision until you understand it. Meaning, don't put your intelligence as a determinant of whether you'll do something or not.
Okay.
Okay. So that's why those two cases. Just parenthetically. Everybody see it? Okay, good. Cal, Doug, is that clear?
I guess I'm not. The point is clear, but it's not clear to me why it would appear in this case, but not in others, because it's simply saying, don't put your intelligence before the decision to obey a commandment.
Yeah, I'm not sure also in terms of why circumcision, but the point is there. I agree with your question. It could have been by like tefillin or tzitzis too, right?
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay.
Okay, so I see you got it online, Les. Good. Okay. All right, so you see, it gives a nice illustration of the exactitude of the Torah's words. I mean, God's wisdom is perfect. So if the word tumim is being used only two times, there must be a message over there. And it makes sense. Okay. Okay, so now in terms...
I'm sorry. Yeah, but let me just clarify something for myself.
Yeah.
Basically, what you're saying is to be complete, to be tumim with Hashem means to be complete and following Him completely, not deviating from the path.
Meaning following Him alone.
Alone.
And the way you deviate from following Him alone is if you follow other powers, if you think there's any forces or superstitions. I mean, people have this throughout their life. They're very superstitious. They're looking for security in life. So they assume that this is good luck or that is and so on. But they have to really strip that away from themselves, that there is only God running the world. There's natural law, of course. But the only power, the only intelligence is God.
Yeah, I remember as a young girl, the red, it wasn't a red string around the wrist, but it was a red ribbon, to wear the red ribbon to forestall a bad eye.
Yep, that's all nonsense. All
yeah,
nonsense.
It goes the same thing.
Right.
Amazing, and you believe it. You're instilled with that.
Yep.
Very odd. But then once you realize, once it's clear, it helps you to.
Yeah, the only path.
Correct.
The only path to counter those beliefs is intelligence. Does it make sense or not? If it can't be proven, a person should not follow it.
Right. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so now that the King Salman had brought, you know, come full circle, and he showed that the person's got to follow a rational path, even though there's some deviation, like we said, but nonetheless, that's a minority of cases, and he should follow it. Nonetheless, he says in verse 11 that the intelligence will sometimes fall on deaf ears. That itself is an illustration to us that don't think that that now creates a defect in intelligence. Right? Maybe that's why he's bringing it up, because now that he's trying to make a case for following an intelligent life, you may have questions. Hey, it's not working on this one person. Well, that's not a flaw, he says, in intelligence. That's a flaw in the recipient, that the person's a fool and he can't hear it. Don't let that be a detraction of the greatness of wisdom. So that he illustrates in 11. Because again, when you make a case for something, you have to anticipate what the questions are going to be that people might have on it. You want to say, here's a rule that intelligence is great. Well, what about sometimes the fool who ends up being the highest position in power? Well, that's a minority of cases, but that does not take away from the reasonable approach of life, that you should always have a good plan. Isn't it always wiser to make a plan for something than not to have a plan at all? Of course. All right, so sometimes even the best plan, we said earlier that you have one rogue warrior in an army, he could destroy the greatest plan. Right, you need everybody in the army to be pulling together, and that's why there's a chain of command, and that's why there has to be complete obedience. And you know, the uniform, there's no real identity of the individual. That's the concept of they give them all the crew cuts and they give them the same uniform. There's no individuality. You're all following the plan, and you have to have that loyalty. And if there's one person that doesn't follow it, he could ruin the best plan. So wisdom is the best approach, even though some cases it may not pan out. That is not a poor reflection. We don't say that because of that, then just throw away wisdom. No. You work out 100 mathematical formulas and the numbers work out great and everything. One formula you can't figure out, you don't say the 99 other ones are at fault. Okay. So now we go on to the next verse, a new verse, new ground. And it says as follows. It says, the words of the wise, of the mouth of the wise, are chen. Chen means they find favor. I mean, they're proper. But the lips of the fool will swallow him up. All right, Ibn Ezra says that the words of the mouth of the wise people. So Ibn Ezra says as follows, far be it that it should be that a wise person, when he speaks, that he only speaks words that are favorable. I mean, that's how a wise person operates. His speech will be favorable. But the fool, he destroys his soul with his speech. And that's what King Solomon says, that he swallows himself up. But he says he destroys himself in the singular. So what is he talking about?
Bottom line is, if you become a fool, you did it to yourself. You destroyed yourself.
All right.
So, I mean, along those lines, I think that's what they're trying to explain.
So then he shouldn't have mentioned the first part of the verse.
I'm sorry, what's the first part? Maybe I missed it.
The words of the mouth of the wise person are favorable.
The words of a wise person is favorable. It's better to be friends with a wise person. They'll tell you when you're being a fool. They'll tell you.
Well, no, that's true. But we're trying to understand what's the connection between the first part of the verse and the second part of the verse.
Okay. missing something.
We have to look at the verse. What is the first part of saying that the words of the wise person, of the speech of the wise, or divrei pi, the words of the mouth of the wise person are favorable, but the lips of the fool will swallow him up. So he's giving a contrast. But in both cases, he's talking about speech or lips. And what does that have to do, how does that fit in with what we're discussing?
Mm-hmm.
So look at the verse and see if you can pull out from the context and also from the verse itself. And you see, he goes on in 13. He says, the beginning of the words of the mouth of the fool, the beginning of the words of the mouth of the fool are foolishness, and the latter end of his words are evil madness. And in 14, he continues, he says, and the fool increases a multitude of words. And according to one verse, the fool actually says the next thing. He says, a man doesn't know what will be and what's going to happen at the end of things. Who's going to tell him? All right, so he's a series of verses here now dealing with speech. So let's understand the first thing. What is he doing by now entering into this content? He's now talking about speech now all of a sudden. How does this follow? Unless you're writing that a person who applies wisdom when interacting with others will find a good path, but a person who does not act wisely in his interactions will suffer as a fool. Okay, true. Let's try to focus on the speech. If you notice, that's what's going on here in the next three verses.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Does it have to do with engaging the intelligent, and that a wise person will speak with intelligence where a fool will just speak without really engaging his brain?
Very good. Right, because now that we just concluded that although, you know, that's what we said before, that, no, not your point, your point is a good point, but let me just show you how I agree, why I agree, is because King Solomon was giving you a plan, and it said, even despite the fact that I told you that wisdom is good, there'll be certain times where you won't understand why there's going to be an inverted positions in the social order, and these people who should be in the bottom are on top, and vice versa, and he says, nonetheless, you're still better off to have a wise plan. And then he says, and it's, even though wisdom is true and it's great, it's not always going to, it may fall on deaf ears sometimes. But now he's speaking about wisdom and that there's a problem that sometimes when you speak to somebody, it's not going to be effective. We might come away with the concept that now speech is something which carries wisdom in it. But now he's countering that, like you said, that he's continuing now that speech is really something which is reflective, it's synonymous almost with intelligence. I say almost because not all speech is intelligent, and that's what I believe what he's trying to address now. Because now that King Solomon said that he showed you how intelligence is always better than having no intelligence, having a plan is better, and there will be times when you'll speak to somebody and it won't work, so now he just basically said he interchanged speech and intelligence with speech. So now you might come away thinking that all speech carries intelligence. Because man, what else besides man talks? Meaning man is the only speaking animal. So you might have this concept that speech is something which inherently is intelligent. And I believe, like you're saying, if I understand you, that he now goes on to speech and shows you that don't let that be, that's not altogether true. That is not something which is altogether true. Because you see, even though he's using speech to reflect the intelligence of a wise person, and sometimes that speech is not going to help, but don't think that all speech is good. And that's why he first gives the rule now. Now that we've brought up speech and we're talking about intelligence, is the best way to live, but don't think that speech and intelligence are always synonymous, because you could have the speech, the words of the mouth of the wise person find favor, like Ibn Ezra says, God forbid that a wise person should ever say something which doesn't contain wisdom. At a certain point of development, the person becomes so attached to wisdom, his speech is going to be reflecting, because that's how a wise person develops, that what he feels worthy of enunciating is going to be which moves his soul. And what moves the soul of a wise person is only intelligence. But the lips of the fool don't think because he's saying, because he's making noise with his lips, that that means there's intelligence there too. And if you look at the verse, there's something more to it, because he says the words of the mouth of the wise man are favor. But he doesn't say the words, right? At least in this verse he says that it's the lips, meaning the lips of the fool. The very apparatus is something which is only going to produce nonsense. It's going to destroy him. I mean, there's no. It's like saying that there's no way out for him. You're saying the very fact that something is coming out of his lips, forget it. He's not following intelligence. Anything he says can't be intelligent. Right, the mouth is going to be a reflection of what moves the person. So he corrects that right from the outset.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Basically, you say what's on your mind. The person once said there was a little poem that Rabbi Miller, the soul, let him rest in peace, he told to the congregation that he said, when somebody's dressed up in fine clothes and somebody's dressed up in whatever, a costume, they don't know who you are until you open your mouth. And the Pope was talking about a donkey who was dressed up as a horse, and nobody knew it was a donkey until he opened his mouth to bray. Basically, what it means that we knowledge come out of our mouths, and that's how people know who we really are. So that's how people can tell if we're a fool or we're intelligent or whatever.
Right. Okay. Les, you're asking whether speech reflects a person's wisdom or the lack thereof, but does not contain the wisdom itself. I'm not sure what you're asking. So if you just want to write something, just elaborate on screen on that. Okay. Okay, so that's an important first step. The person should not think that speech is synonymous with intelligence. Okay, what does he say next? He says a very interesting thing now. Now he says in 13, the beginning of the words of the fool's mouth are foolishness, and the latter end is evil madness. So he's now making comparison between the initial words that a fool utter and after he talks for a while, what will the reaction is going to be? Evil madness. That's what people are going to say about him. So why should that be? So it's interesting that, okay, Les, I see a note on screen. Thank you. All right, so it's interesting that the way it appears to work is that a fool is going to speak, and evidently we respond as foolishness because speech is, for example, a person grabs an apple a certain way and eats it. We don't care if it's sloppy or if it's, you know, very finesse, you know, etiquette. We're not going to necessarily ridicule the person as being stupid or as a fool based on how he eats an apple. But speech we do recognize as being something that should reflect intelligence. That's basically what a sentence is. It's an expressed thought. It's something that you're communicating because it's a value. So when we hear somebody speak, there's an expectation that there should be some intelligence. So the beginning of a person's words, if they're foolishness, so that's how we respond. We respond that it's foolishness. A person said something which is nonsense. However, if a person continues on that path, so a person may say one statement and he has an error. You know, people do make errors. They can make a statement which is an error. But there's a difference between saying something, an individual point that's an error, and then hearing a whole sequence of words and thoughts. Then that reflects something more about the person, the manner of how he thinks, the process, the sequence of sentences that are coming out of his mouth. That now shows a pattern of thinking that's much greater than simply an individual statement that he could be wrong about. So that's why the end of the words of the fool are going to be evil madness. Because the fool will have a series of sentences reflect the pattern of his thinking, not an individual error. And that's why King Solomon says that the beginning of the words of the fool are going to be foolishness. Because anything he says is really going to be flawed. He's not using intelligence. So even the beginning, even the very first expressions of his mouth are going to be nonsensical. But if you listen long enough, it's going to be an evil madness that he's so deviant in terms of his process of thinking that the process of thinking can't be ascertained until he's talked for a while. So he's showing you two corruptions in the fool, and how they're detected by a person.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Could it also be that one who listens or is affected by it, in the sense of following what this foolishness is, could create an evil madness?
Well, I think an intelligent person, when he hears foolishness, he'll be on guard and not follow it. I don't think hearing a person speak once is going to affect them.
Right, but other foolish people that would listen to it that think it sounds good could create an evil madness within a group.
But there's no need to go there, because he's talking about an individual. So I think to keep it simple, let's keep it, you know, referring to the individual. Let me see what it says here. Let's look at the commentators now. All right. So Ibn Ezra says there's no rhyme or reason to his words, beginning or end. Okay, that's all he says on it. Let's take a look at Sforno. Let me see if I understand what Sforno is saying here. So he says there's a dialogue going on. That seems to be the theme that he's following. Because as we said earlier, that if the snake bites without being charmed, so what use is the speaker? That was verse 12. There he explained it to me, and so what use is it for the wise person to try to rebuke the fool? He's just going to continue in his evil path. So Sforno is taking this up to be a dialogue. So that means then that, let's see what he says on 12. Right. So what does it mean that in 12 that the words of the fool will swallow him up? So Sforno says as follows. He says, therefore, the words of the mouth of the wise that are favorable, nonetheless, the words of the fool will swallow up those good words of the wise person, meaning in the dialogue. It'll swallow up, meaning it'll obscure or destroy any value that the favorable words of the wise person had with his foolish words that he responds. And Sforno goes on and he says, at the beginning of the words of the fool are nonsense. It destroys that favorable, he continues, he says it destroys those favorable words of the wise person. And he says, and also, and afterwards, the latter end of his mouth, that it's an evil madness. And with this, the fool will increase his words, which is what he says in the next verse, in 14. Which is true, that a person feels sometimes that if he talks enough that this is something which can win a conversation. I've had conversations with people that I'm not sure, there's one person who I suspected they had a real emotional imbalance. I didn't know this from the outset because you don't assume that about most people. But the person kept on repeating over and over again, as soon as I'd open my mouth to say something, they cut me off and they repeated it again. And they put a lot of emotion into their words, but they weren't saying anything. But perhaps they felt that by saying something over and over again, that would now carry more weight than just saying it once. Or just saying something in many, many ways. And we talked about that a couple of times, that the heretic will do that. But they'll try to launch numerous attacks, even though they're all foolish. But they feel if they say enough, oh look, there's an abundance of words I'm saying. I must be right. People are really taken by that. If there's a book written on something, oh, there's got to be some truth to it. But again, we're clear, and we just listen to the idea. Is it true or is it not true? Very, very, very simple. So Sforno's saying that the fool will obliterate the favorable words by talking. He'll follow an evil madness. He's not following anything reasonable, so he's going to veer off the path of the reasoned approach of what the wise person was trying to advise him. But I think it's true also what we said is that there's a difference between an individual statement, which is foolishness, and why something becomes an evil madness if they continue. Because then it reveals the very workings of the fool. And it's the most distasteful thing to a person who's rational. The person's not following any type of path of reason, of intelligence. And what is he saying? What actually are the words? Let's do the next verse, 14. The fool will increase his words, and he'll say that the person doesn't know what will be. And what's going to be afterwards, who's going to tell him? He says two arguments. He says, Lo yeda ha'adam ma'ashiyeh. Person doesn't know what's going to be. Why does he say that? Why is that the response to the wise person? If we follow Sforno's lead here, there's a dialogue going on between the wise person and the fool. So the fool responds, and he talks a lot. And one thing he says is that the person doesn't know what's going to be. Why does he say that? Why is that the response? The sense of, of course, King Solomon is distilling the basic message of what the fool is saying. And Sforno says like this in 14. He says that when the chacham, when the wise person yells and rebukes the fool that's causing his idiocy, his foolishness, and he warns him, don't add in your destructive ways. So then the fool's going to respond, and he says what? He says the following words. Behold, a person doesn't know what's going to be in the future. what causes this? Let me see if I have this right. One second. V'yomer, hinei lo yoda ha'adam, ma shehiyeh. Person doesn't know what's going to be now. The cause of this foolishness, or the cause of my downfall. And he says that his negative life, I mean the fool says, my negative life is not due to any type of foolishness. I mean, he's trying to defend himself. And then he continues, and he says, and when it occurs that the person who's wise, and he says to him, they shouldn't continue to break down the fence, what we talked about before. A person breaks a fence, the snake will bite him. Sforno meant to say, it's a warning from the wise person. If you break down the rabbinic decrees, which are like a fence, you're going to get hurt. So now Sforno says that when the wise person tells the fool that you shouldn't continue to break the fence, meaning, metaphorically, you shouldn't continue to break down the Torah laws, perhaps you'll get bitten by the snake, meaning you'll hurt yourself in your life, philosophically. So he responds at the end of his words, and he says, you don't know the future. Who told you? Meaning to say, it's not the way of a person that he can judge the future. And with this, Sforno says, he makes a narration. Sforno gives his own commentary, and he says like this. And he says, with this, the fool thinks like an animal who only senses that's what's present and in front of him. He says the fool now is acting just like an animal, because an animal has no anticipation. An animal has no thought. He can't anticipate. He can't assume or assess what will happen in the future. All an animal knows is what it sees and what it senses. But you see what the fool is doing when he says, you don't know the future. Why is that the response of the fool? Why is he attacking the wise person by saying, oh, you don't know what the outcome of actions will be, you don't know the future? Why is that what he says to the wise person?
Is it because he despises the concept of consequences and doesn't want to acknowledge that the wise person can tell what's going to happen?
Yeah, very good, exactly. Because he, like Doug just said, like the fool does not want to deal with consequence. He wants to ignore that so he can pave the way just to keep following his emotions. He doesn't want to deal with the consequence. But that's also what the wise person was telling the fool. He says, don't continue in your ways because this will happen. Because what happened already, you can't talk about it. You can't correct the past. So the wise person that tries to assist the fool is going to try to advise him on future steps. And that has to be, you know, teamed with, if you do A, B will happen. If you do C, then D will happen. So since that's the nature of the discussion, that's what the response of the fool is going to be. He's going to try to ignore that. He doesn't want to face consequence. He wants to have his just instinctual lifestyle. So what does he do? He says, oh, people don't know the future. Who told you? Two things he says. You don't know it. And where is this? He says it can only be from a person. So who else is out there that maybe is smarter that told you? But again, the reason why he's talking about the future, that's why this, the response of the fool is, because that's precisely what the wise person is trying to admonish him on. But King Solomon doesn't have to tell us what the admonishment of the wise person is. From the response of the fool, we can derive it. So King Solomon just gives us the response of the fool, and now we see, we can deduce, oh, it must have been that the wise person is advising him on steps for the future, which makes sense. You're not talking about the past. You can't change the past. And then the fool wants to reject that and not have to follow the wise person, the chacham. And the way he can get out of that is by saying, nobody knows the future 100%. And that to him is sufficient. That's always the response of the fool. If they can find one loophole, that's enough to disqualify everything, which of course we said is foolish. The very approach that King Solomon was teaching us is that even though you may find an exceptional case, don't abandon intelligence and don't abandon a life where you're following nature and laws and plans. Because for the most part, you're going to work out, things will work out better. They'll pan out better with a plan, with intelligence, because that's how the world operates. You follow the laws of nature. But that's not how a fool operates. The fool, the heretic, or the skeptic, they operate just by wanting to have a justification for their lifestyle. And all they need to justify is just to have a question that doesn't have an answer. And here he says, you don't know the future. All right, but what does he add by saying, who told you? And what's going to be at the end? Who has told you? Why? What more does a fool add with that? Right, that's the end of verse 14. Interesting question, right?
Yep.
Rabbi, could you repeat the question again? I'm sorry.
And the question is that once the fool rejects the wise person's counsel, because the wise person is telling him, don't keep following this lifestyle because you do X and Y and Z will happen. So since the fool just wants to have his satisfaction in the moment, he says to the wise person, well, a person does not know what's going to be. So that should be sufficient rejection. Person doesn't know what's going to be. You don't have 100% knowledge of what's going to happen. You don't know for sure that if I do this, that's going to happen. So that should be sufficient as a response. Why does he have to say additionally, and the end of matters? Who has told you? Didn't he already say that? It sounds like he's saying the same answer twice. Or the same response twice, I should say.
Yes, but if somebody has gone through that experience, they know what the results will be, so they can say, this is what is going to happen.
But I know, but the fool already told them, well, you don't know. No man knows the future 100%.
It's not a question of knowing the future. It's a question of knowing... I mean, if you put your hand on the fire, you're going to get burnt. But you did before. That's the extent.
Well, we're not talking about that case. That of course, that's something which you can't deny. We're talking about it must be a case where it's deniable.
Oh, I see.
Like if you eat too much, you're going to get sick, or something like that. Or you know, if you keep on playing the lottery, you're going to go broke, and you're not going to have any money. Well, that's something which he could deny. So once he's already said you don't know the future. What more does the fool gain by saying, and the end of matters, who has told you? It sounds like the same thing he's saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a question. What's the apparent repetition? There's got to be there has to be some new point there. I don't have the answer. I'm thinking myself right now.
Oh, sorry.
You have a class today with Rabbi Moskowitz?
Yes, as far as I know.
Okay. So you want to think about this? This week, what time is your class with Rabbi Moskowitz start?
12:45.
Oh, so you have like 25 minutes.
Yes.
All right, so let's take another 5 minutes. Let's just take another 5 minutes and think about this and see if we can come up with this. It would be nice if we could wrap it up. Let me just clarify. So he already said to the wise person, Man does not know what will be. So that's like an attack on the wise person. I'm the fool. I'm talking to the wise person that just rebuked me and told me to stop my ways because I'll end up ruining myself. So I say back to the wise person, man, you don't know the future. Now, if I said that, what do I gain by saying, who told you what's going to happen at the end? It sounds like repetition, but he does bring in one new thing. The second thing, he says, there's another person involved. Who has told you? The first thing is my attack on the wise person, just him. I'm attacking him. But then I add on and I say, besides the fact that you don't know, nobody else told you. But that seems to be a problem, because if you can't know, why would anybody else know? Who cares if somebody told you? Maybe they don't know either. It sounds as if like he's saying that, well, if somebody else did tell you, then I'd have to back off. Then I'd have to agree.
I feel lost, I have
Yeah, the one commentary wants to say that he's denying the person who spoke to him. And he says, you don't know anything. And when he says, who else told you? That's a denial of prophecy. Meaning, is there a prophet out there? And he says, even that he denies. I mean, not only you, a regular person, you can't know the future, but even the prophecies I'm denying, which is... That's good, because if the person that I'm attacking, hey, you don't know the future, so who cares if somebody else told it to him? That person also shouldn't know the future, right? But if he says the person's a prophet, that can mean that's what he has to address also. He says, you, a typical person, you don't know, you can't warn me and say X is going to happen because I do this because you don't know the future. And even people who claim to have knowledge of the future, I mean, the prophets, he's denying. Right, you see the difference? Right. I was thinking of another thing. Without even going into that answer, you could possibly say that, first of all, it exposes the foolishness of the fool. Because if you already said with one answer that, you know, you don't know the future, so to say that somebody else is going to tell you, it shows he's a fool. He's not even thinking about what he's saying. Because if you already said that person A doesn't know the future, so what's the use of you warning me? You don't know the future. So anybody else is not going to know it either. So by the fact that he says the latter end of the pasuk, the verse, and he says, and plus, who else told you? So this shows that he's not thinking rationally, because it exposes... is an assumption that, well, if somebody else has said it, maybe now that he's going to follow people. He won't follow a person, but he might follow people, meaning he's impressed by what more than one person does, as opposed to being impressed with the truth. So what he's saying here could expose his way of thinking. He just follows the crowd. His attack on the person is, you don't know the future, you're just one person. And nobody else told you about it. Oh, but if somebody else did tell you about it, the fool is confessing that maybe he would back off. So it might be exposing the way he thinks. The same idea that the one person, the wise person, warns him about, that he rejects. But if somebody else would tell it to him, then he might back off. Just because of numbers. That could be. All right, let's leave it. We can think a little bit about it over the week and then maybe try to revisit it next week. But see if you can find any commentators on it or think about it yourself. We'll pick up next week on this point, all right?
Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody.
Thank you.
And have a great week, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, too.
Okay.